So our agenda is there. I'm up to scribe today. Let's see. On the agenda today, we have issue 100, whether or not the JSON-LD API should have a mode strict flag. Issue 112, defining mandatory API parameters via options. 81, round tripping, again, precision and how doubles are expressed. Issue 110, which is figuring out more specific frame matching. 114, which is the value space of keywords. And then 115, which is what to do with all native types in expanded form, whether value should be injected or not for that. Is there anything else that we should add to the agenda or any changes?
Yeah, maybe perhaps just wondering if we should treat the syntax-related ones first. I don't know.
Yeah.
A quick question. This was a super session today.
It is, yeah. We're
all
basically
right.
Super sessioning until we feel like we're done.
And luckily,
go ahead, sorry.
I can only stay for 1 hour. So
okay, that's fine. Okay, so let's rearrange the agenda.
I think we should also try to get to the things that Nicholas perhaps would like to weigh in on.
Okay. Which ones are those, Nicholas?
I'm afraid I'm not really sure at this point. I haven't had time to focus too much on this. So pick the ones you feel are most important and try to weigh in.
It looks like issue 115, issue 114 have to do with syntax, could potentially impact syntax, as well as issue 81 potentially, and then the rest of it's kind of API stuff. So we're going to deal with difficult issues first, which is probably the way we should be doing it anyway. So. All right, here we go. Issue 115. So, let's see. Marcus, would you like this? Could you take us through the kind of an introduction to the issue?
Which one is that? No. Okay. Yeah, that basically came up while discussing framing with Greg and Dave. And, well, the thing is that there are different ways to express a value in JSON-LD, so either plain literal or, well, a number, for example. So you can either just have it directly as a property value, or you can put it in at value. And, yeah, it can be in an array or not in an array. But in expanded form, it's always an array, and we introduced that optimization, which eliminates that add value and replaces it with the value of add value. But that hasn't been done for, like, add ID, for example, for add graph, and I think that was the reason why it came up in our discussion.
It was interesting. It was actually a little backwards, I think. With regards to add graph, it was the issue for subject references, whether they should be expressed in the expanded form, which is I think what we had at that point, or not, or just as strings. And that's where
I think we sort of
took that off into other directions. So the calling it about add value is actually only one of the issues. Really, in general, does expanded form really mean expanded? Or because it's possible to take something that's an expanded form and when doing expansion actually compact it, which is a little bit oxymoronic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I always saw expanded form as IRI, in terms of IRI expansion and not really of making everything the most verbose. We're expressing everything in the most verbose way as possible.
So the initial thought behind Expanded Form was to provide a data structure that is very regular, that developers could code against if they didn't want to have to deal with queries and basically compact form. So compact form throws a wrench in things because you need to do a lot of if branching to figure out what the value is and whether it's a number or whether it's a type literal, all that kind of stuff. So expanded form was basically, here is a solid data structure that you can write a very simple algorithm against to effectively crawl the data. So that's where it came from. So I think that, Marcus, your understanding of what expanded form is wasn't necessarily what we had intended in the beginning for expanded form.
No, I mean, I agree with that, but I don't agree with that in every regard. So I don't see why everything being expressed in an at value object is more regular than having strings and numbers as numbers. And everything that has a type attached in an at value object. And the same applies for IRIs and for at ID, at type, and at graph, which will, at least that was my understanding, are always IRI values. So I didn't even think about literals for graph names in the first place.
Okay.
But yeah, I definitely agree that expanded form should be regular or as regular as possible.
Okay, so I guess then my question is, if the overriding goal, so we've really have two issues here. One of them is whether or not to expand graph to have a value of a JSON object with ID in expanded form, and then the second one is whether or not all values get expanded to a JSON object containing value in expanded form. All right. So those are basically the two issues that we have. Does that seem okay?
And number one triggered this discussion.
Right. And perhaps we should resolve it the other way around. I think if we resolve what two is, then one becomes easier to resolve. So let's see. Well, Marcus, I guess the your concern is that if we go and we expand absolutely everything in expanded form, that we are adding verbosity and we're adding memory overhead and processing overhead. Basically, the implementations have to do a lot more work to crawl the data structure. That's one of your concerns. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And I think, I mean, like, I also don't expect that many developers, JSON developers, to use attype, for example. So I think, like, difficult to say a number, but let's say 80% of the times you just deal with the native data types, and that's enough.
Okay.
One question, though I don't really know if it has bearing, is whether regular JSON, developers expecting just regular JSON will like to deal with the expanded form at all. I mean, it's inherently a lot of graphy concepts in there.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they. So you're saying would they probably end up working with compact form more often than not?
Yeah. Yes, I think so. I mean, consider the users of RDF JSON. The shape of RDF-JSON is entirely predictable, but the case against it has always been that it's illegible for someone expecting just plain old JSON. And, I mean, the expanded form of JSON-LD is very similar to RDF-JSON in its verbosity. Mm-hmm. So I absolutely think that we should aim for predictability and that we shouldn't necessarily expand anything that is predictable in a less expanded form. But we should sort of try to get our bearings on which perspective, which kind of users we are catering for.
Yeah, I mean, that's a bit difficult because everyone has its own ideas and we don't have any information about how people are eventually going to use that. So.
No, but given the shape of the expanded form, we should reasonably expect that people won't just like to get such data into their JavaScripts and do stuff with it in a very specific application context. But this is rather like a sort of information exchange format for extremely detailed information.
Well, I mean, like, just because all the IRIs are expanded makes it quite attractive, I would say. If you build an API browser, for example, you can just follow the links by clicking on it.
Yeah, but you wouldn't follow the property links all the time.
Well, but you could, you know, have a tooltip which loads dynamically some description or some label or some document from there. But yeah, I mean, that's just speculation.
Yeah, but that's if you want to present the RDF perspective, if you will, on that information. Because if you have URIs as properties, that's not end user JSON, so to speak. It's middleware JSON.
It's not the type of JSON that a developer would typically expect. Usually, I think they're going to create their JSON that makes it convenient to use dot notation and to access things, which is really the whole point of, you know, framing in compaction, is to be able to get things in that form. I think the argument for expanded form is to get things in the most normal sense so that it can be processed further, not necessarily to be used as a format in itself. And in that regard, knowing that every time I have a property, that the value is going to be expressed as an array of objects really simplifies things. It's not an array that might be a string of what might be a string or might be an object.
No, exactly. You should always be able to know what to do next. You shouldn't have to look ahead. The only thing you need to do is to check for a key to determine a branch, if it's a resource reference or if it's a value, or a nested graph if we support that eventually.
Okay, well, I mean, based on that, that says that the decision that we should make is to expand it out into value. Even given Marcus's concerns, which I think are valid, the point of expanded form is certainly not for JSON. It's what Greg said. The point of expanded form is so that you can process it further into something else, right? It's not necessarily that you're going to be using it directly to in your API. So I don't expect that anyone's REST API would ever be producing expanded form as the standard way of operation, right? They would want to use it. They would want to produce it as a JSON that you can pull in and then use dot notation to access. And this is in fact the same kind of thing that we've come to the conclusion with the PaySorm APIs over the past week. I think last week we made a decision to basically remove all queries in the standard objects that are returned. So basically that means that what people get back from the PaySorm APIs looks exactly like just regular JSON, right? And even the values are very, very specific. We try not to deviate with the values. So we try not to use expanded form, or we try not to make it such that expanded form could be used for string values or other things like that. So of course, the API, when the REST API consumes JSON-LD, it can take it in any form. But what it produces for developers is something that's very familiar to JSON people. It doesn't have any, it's certainly not expanded form, and it doesn't have any weird requirements to do branching. So all that to say that it seems like Nicholas, Greg, and I are making the assertion that expanded form is meant for further processing, and it should be very, very normal. And based on that, that means we should expand all property values to an expanded add value. And if we do that, then that resolves the issue of what happens if we want to have it resolves the issue of what's a graph in expanded form. That means that we're going to have to create an object with an ID in it. And the other thing that it does is makes it possible, or makes the path to supporting graph named graphs having literal identifiers an easier kind of thing to implement. In fact, it's already done if we make it the decision like that. So Marcus, is there still concern over the direction of, let's say that we do expand all property values into their expanded form, so at value, and then the native form, you don't have to convert it to string, so it's a string, a JSON number, or whatever. Is that still a fairly large concern for you?
Maybe to help me, if you could show me two examples how this would make applications easier, or how this would make the data structure more regular, because I can't really see any.
Okay, sure. So
I mean, every check I have to do gets more complicated.
Yeah, so I guess, yes, that's absolutely right. Every check that you have to do makes things more complicated. So when you're processing, let's say, something in expanded form, and you've got this recursive algorithm and it's a function, let's say that you're just printing it out to n triples format, right? So you get your subject, you know what your subject is, you know what your property is because it's expanded. Those are easy. Now, when you go to print the value, if we didn't fully go all out and use a JSON object to normalize it, you would have to check to see if the value is a number, a string, or an object. So that's a three-branched statement that you'd have to implement. If we had fully normal form, what I think Greg and I are proposing, and Dave Longley are proposing, then you wouldn't have that branching in there at all. You would just go into the JSON object knowing that that's the value of the property, and then you would effectively just print the value of at value. So, whether it's a, you might still have to check
to
see.
Then you're losing the type. Otherwise, I just check.
No. You don't lose the type. It's still there.
But you can't just print that value then. You have to check if type.
That's true.
I don't think the point is to say that that's exactly what you would do. I mean, and there is always going to be a certain amount of conditional branching. But right now, I'd have to go through and iterate for. I already know that the values associated with a property are an array. Right now, I would need to say if it's a string, I would do one thing. Otherwise, it must be an object, and then I would do different things based upon what's in that object. This allows me to flatten that out so that the values are always going to be an object, and I would say if it has an ID, then you do one set of branches. Otherwise, it must have a value. And if it has a value, does it have a type? Does it have a language? And then lastly, is the value in the range of a string, a Boolean, or a number?
But that's
exactly. So there's going to be branching.
Anyway.
there's going to be branching, but it does allow me to flatten it out because now everything is going to be in an object representation rather than possibly in a string representation or number, Boolean, or object.
Yeah. It also makes the program more consistent in that it makes it more modular, right? So you can have something that just processes values. You could have a recursive function that just processes, value objects, expanded form value objects.
Yeah, but still, I mean, the checks are exactly the same either way. I have to check if it's a string or not. I have to check if type is there or not. I have to check if it's a number or a Boolean. It's always the same.
You're doing that in the context of it being an object, though, rather than in the context of it being an array value.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't do this, but allow plain values directly, you would have to first check if it's an object, and then if it has a value, treat it as a plain, that value as a plain value. Or if it's a plain value directly, you do the same thing. So it's a more complex algorithm if we mix the types. So I agree with what Greg outlined in his scenario. I think that's the most regular shape.
Mm-hmm.
Also, that's very consistent with how similar formats look, say Sparkle results and RDF.json. They all have this regularity in their shapes.
Well, I still can't see it, but okay.
Hmm. Well, I don't know if it helps, but I mean, we did hit this issue. In fact, you know, we've hit this issue multiple times just writing JavaScript code. So to give you an example, I had to do this RDFA editor type thing over the weekend, and we had these data structures. The library I was using had these data structures that weren't very regular, and so I ended up having to write quite a bit of code to see exactly what the value of something was. It was more complicated because I was having to do it kind of at a higher level. It's difficult to explain why this is an issue until you end up having the right code to deal with the issue. The same thing with our C++ code. I mean, it would be simplified if we did it this way that Dave Longley and Greg have proposed versus allowing more variation in what a property's value can be, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know how convincing this has been, Marcus, but I think that there's a fairly there's at least broad agreement with I think among Nicholas, Greg, myself, and Dave Longley that this is what we want to do for expanded form. We believe it's going to make things simpler to do it this way. So
maybe I'm missing something, but yeah, I'm not going to block on this.
Okay.
If you all agree on that, it's fine for me as well.
Okay. Well, so there's still time. There's still time to change our minds effectively on this. So let's go ahead and make this decision for the time being, and then if it all of a sudden something pops up, because both Greg and Dave Longley are doing implementations on this, if something pops up that says, oh no, this actually made it more difficult to work with the data, then we can always go back. And of course, if someone objects to it in the RDF working group or wherever this thing gets standardized, we can rewind this decision at that point as well. Greg.
But will that then apply for everything, like also for at type, for example?
We still need to discuss that, but probably not. I wouldn't expect it to. I think we're...
Or I think the other one was,
Greg
says, is at ID. Could at ID be expressed as value with a type of ID? And I don't see the value in in doing
yeah,
that.
In that we don't necessarily allow, we don't allow any other type of identifier other than in IRI in both of those positions. And there's nothing in the RDF world that says that that's going to ever happen.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think every discussion that I've heard about identifiers has looked at literals being used as an identifier, and there's been a lot of discussion on potential use cases, and at the end people go, oh yeah, well it's kind of neat and all, but I don't think we want to make RDF more complicated by doing that. So that people always fall back to, well, if you need some kind of textual-based identifier, just mint a new IRI scheme, like myid:foo, and use that.
So that means we would expand everything to add value except for type, and I don't know about graph, not...
NID.
NID, yeah. Yeah, we still need to talk about graph, but...
I mean, graph type and ID are just as built in as the value key itself, so it wouldn't make sense to expand those more than necessary.
Well, I think the issue that sort of prompted this was, what are the values of at graph? And it we did have it as being an expanded form. It can be a subject definition or subject reference, meaning an object with not ID, and possibly other properties, versus saying it could be a string, which is always interpreted as an IRI, or an object. So my feeling was that it should always be an object form. And doing that also allows us at some point to extend it to include value if we decide that it makes sense for the context position in a triple to be a value.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, not doing so would also allow us to introduce that value for that. That doesn't prevent us to do that.
Mm-hmm. The thing that the RDF that keeps coming back up is should values be used or literals be used as in the subject area, and that we don't have a good way to express. But I don't really see that happening. So.
Okay, so the proposal then would be to ensure that all property values expressed in all property values are in general, ensure that all property values are expressed in expanded value form, example, value Okay, in general, ensure that all property values are expressed in expanded value form. Okay, hold on. In general, for expansion, ensure that all property values are expressed in expanded value form. Okay. And then I've left, I guess, with the exception of ID and type. And then the very next thing we're going to discuss is graph. Okay, so ID and type are the only ones that don't get expressed in expanded value form. Is that right?
That's the question.
Okay, and then graph we're going to discuss. Okay, so how's this for a proposal?
from my point of view, I don't really think that ID and type are exceptions to the rule, but well, it depends on the how deep you look into what they represent. But
yeah.
I think that they are very syntactically, how do you say, standard. They are standing for themselves, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're atomic, I guess. You can't break them down any further. Primitive.
With the sort of, from my RDF point of view, exception on type, of course, which we discussed elsewhere, but which I'm fine with.
Right.
That type is super, super key.
Yeah. Okay, so the next thing is, I guess the next question is whether or not we want to make sure that graph is expressed in expanded form as well. And I think that my preference would be to express it in expanded form because of this corner case, because of two things. One, I think it's more normal to do it that way. I think graph is more like all of the, more like the other keywords or other properties than it is ID and type. But I think honestly you could argue this either way. I'd rather go to expanded form for graph because then it, again with the branching is not necessarily as complicated, or it's more constrained, it's more modular, and then we can support at value for a named graph with a text string as the name more easily in the future.
Just a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
If we say we expand it, and you are arguing about the introduction of named graphs, does that mean that it's not allowed to put at graph and directly a string, which is an IRI in there? Or wouldn't that be interpreted as an IRI then?
I believe so. Yeah, I mean, if so there are things that the spec should say that processors must do in expanded form. But I think any JSON-LD processor processing that would understand that as an IRI.
Then because there's no point in expanding it.
No. So the reason is well, we don't want to put that complexity into the spec. I think that that's what a processor should do, but I don't think that we should say that is valid expanded form, if that makes sense. So there are things that processors must do, and that there are things that authors must not do. So an author must not express at graph in when an author is expressing expanded form, they must not. Sorry, when an author and a processor is expressing expanded form, they must not express it as just a text string value. However, if a processor reads that, it should interpret it as an IRI.
It's Postel's rule, right?
Right.
Yeah.
We had a similar case that came up when doing expansion, I believe, in the of type. Is it should a processor actually accept something which is in an object ID form, mm-hmm. which is in there right now? And the reason for that was in the case where you had done a transformation and from RDF and not used at type, but you later wanted to that to be at type so that you basically caused it to be, you created a context that aliased that whatever RDF type was back to at type, in which case the data you have there is an expanded form or could be an expanded form. So that was another case where having a processor accept that, and then in that case translating it into the string form is consistent with Postel's rule.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, given the just I thought of that law when we discussed the previous things, because I think it sort of is the gist of the JSON-LD approach to anything. We are really liberal in what we accept in any kind of shape and form, and we give the tools to the users of JSON-LD contexts and frames to be conservative in their own way, because you can never be conservative in a format is always reducing and removing something, so we can never define that for everybody, but the usage of JSON-LD is to constrain yourself to your own context and eliminate the friction and overhead of a general form.
I guess another way to, I was thinking about the details of this. So if someone does at graph and then does double quote foo, well, I guess there are two ways we could process that. We could process it as relative to the base RRI of the document, which is probably what we'd do. But I was also thinking that we could do some kind of RRI detection. So if there's no colon, then it's a string and not an RRI. But I don't think that works.
No, I think it's useful to consider what the expected range is going to be. In fact, my processor has, when I'm doing IRI expansion, it does sort of pass in the position for expansion. Since properties must be absolute IRIs, types must be absolute IRIs, but other things can be relative IRIs. So in the case of graph, it acts as if there is a coercion to ID, and it is in sort of the subject or object position, meaning that it can be a relative IRI. It certainly would make sense to use like a frag ID in that case, in which mm-hmm. case I was referring to something else that was just in the context of the document.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, so in the case of the graph... Okay, so the proposal for this would be that graph in expanded form, graph is expanded to an expanded ID, effectively, or an array of expanded IDs or expanded ID form. Marcus, are there concerns with that direction? One, do you feel that it's consistent with the previous proposal that we made? And then two, do you feel that that's the right direction to go based on the previous logic, or do you still feel this is unnecessary?
Yeah, based on the previous one, it's definitely the right way to go.
Okay. Okay, so let me write that proposal then. In expanded form, graph is always expressed. In expanded form, graph must be expressed in expanded value form. Expanded form. Graph must be expressed in expanded value form. Okay, so that's that. Does that work? Okay. All right, so I think that's issue 115, is that right?
I think Dave Lane's online, too.
Oh, Dave, plus one, minus one. Okay. All right, issue... Go ahead.
And we don't change type So that's always a strain.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, it's an array of strings in expanded form.
Okay. And when compacting graph now, for example, do I eliminate those at ID objects or do I keep them?
If there's only one, I would expect that you'd collapse it, just like anything else. Meaning that go ahead, Greg.
I think we act as if there is a coercion to ID, in which case the IDs are compacted to strings, and values would be kept if we were to accept values, which we do not currently. But if we were to, they would be kept in the expanded value form. Although you could argue that where it's unambiguous, such as for numbers, Booleans, if that ever made sense to use as the name of a graph, that they wouldn't need to be.
It's worth noticing, you might have talked about this previously, I haven't spent time on this, but this doesn't result in any RDF.
What doesn't result in any RDF?
The example expression, and if you have a graph with just subjects, you have no graph.
Yeah,
right.
That's true.
Right. But what's the point of that? We're not using it as a. It's not an object. It's just an IRI. And typically, that's what you expect. Is the name of a graph is going to be an IRI. I don't even think right now in trig, say, that a bnode can be used as a name of a graph.
But that's not the name of the graph, is it? Isn't graph the graph
that's
key
the content
to be
of the graph?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right.
Exactly.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yes, but what that allows us. Oh, okay. So the reason that we had that form is being a linked data representation, it would make sense to be able that a graph that you could name a linked graph.
Sorry, can I say that?
So if I had a graph which referenced an IRI, it would basically be saying that this thing names this the object with graph names the referenced resource using the ID of the object containing graph.
Yeah,
but wouldn't it be much easier to understand if we keep the expanded form in this case?
Yeah, I think so too.
If you just have at graph and an IRI as the value, a string, then I think people will understand that that's the name of the graph in some cases.
Yeah, I agree. I think in compact form we should keep this shape. That's what you're saying, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see the desire to do that.
Like something like that is quite ambiguous, I would say.
Yeah.
How is it ambiguous? I mean, it's not ambiguous because we know the processing rules tell you exactly how to treat that.
Well, but
in processing,
you're
always going to expand it. I'm sorry?
I think
if you know the spec in and out, then it is unambiguous, of course, but. Like if you just get a JSON document and see that stuff in it, maybe even with the parent parent object not having a net ID, but just some other properties. Let me talk.
So,
how
might you interpret
that?
I
would, if I just glanced at RDF with that in that says it said something about RDF, I would expect that to be the graph identifier.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I see.
For example, in this example, you could say that full graph is the name of the graph.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Yeah, that's. And by expressing it as a subject reference, that becomes unambiguous.
Well, just the subject reference, it's sort of a half. It's not even a graph yet because you don't have any arcs in it. But it's a working document. It's a draft of a
graph.
Well,
so is there, if we want to allow a linked representation of graphs, meaning that I can have one document which names a graph that's specified in another document, and that being consistent with the concept of this being linked data and not RDF, because RDF doesn't really provide you a way to do that, then having that as an IRI sort of, in my mind, would be the natural way to express that. Now, we could say that that's just illegal, that we don't support referencing or linking to other documents to be and naming them. It does sort of, in many respects, sort of feel like the range 14 types of issue is
I'm not arguing.
You can't interpret that document without the reference to it that tells you how to interpret it.
I'm not arguing to disallow that, just to not compact it by default.
Yeah, that's fine.
Well, I just don't know that it seems to me that if I see it in an object form with just an ID, it looks like I've named a graph that has no contents. And maybe that's just, you know, that maybe that's just partway through processing where other steps of processing will provide properties to that graph. But how would I then express that I'm not identifying an empty graph. I'm identifying I'm referencing another document.
I'm not sure. I mean, in my mind, this feels like a conflation of a semantic and a syntactic perspective on what we are expressing here. But I can't really see what the use case is.
The problem with named graphs is that there's only one name. And what is the context in which you're naming? So in Wikidata, my understanding of it is they want to name each statement as having with its own provenance. So that requires basically if you've used this form that where everything's self-contained, you have a SNCC. And within a SNCC is basically a named graph, and then within the outer context are all the properties of that named graph, meaning where it came from and when, and information such as that. But having things at the granularity of a statement where you're naming is incompatible with other types of uses, where you might want to say this is all the set of statements that I got at. From a particular document, in which case you want a different dimension on name. So having the ability to reference a graph with a remotely allows you to have the same set of triples that are associated from different contexts. And if it's all contained in a single document with one dimension of naming, you don't have the ability to do that.
I really need to sketch on that and see some examples to wrap my mind on it, around it. But I think that I don't see why this specific construct supports your use case better than a list of graphs, for instance. And given the wiki data example, it sounds like you need reification, which you could either use with the RDF statement, RDF subject predicate object verbose form,
yes.
or you could bundle a bunch of the.
Although reification seems to be on its way towards obsolescence.
Yeah, but
in support of named graphs.
Yeah, or layers as they might be named.
No.
Let's not go there, as Yvonne would say.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think it really came back to the notion of us being linked data and it then be having it be consistent with us to be able to link to graphs that are named. That was my motivation for considering a use case where it wasn't simply an object or an array of objects, subject definitions, but also potentially subject references, which could be expressed as a string, which as an IRI. But that was sort of expressing an opinion, and it is a worthwhile discussion. I think the fundamental question is, do we want to enable linking to external documents and naming them using the name graph syntax, or not? And if we do, is there some better way to express the intention that IRI or that object, that subject reference, is intended to cause the document to be dereferenced in order to contain the graph that's being named?
Yep. Okay, I don't know if we really need to resolve this today. I think we could have a very long discussion about it, so why don't we step away from the problem for a bit and think about it and then potentially come back to it. I think we've resolved issue 115. I think we may have created a new issue, which is what happens to expanded form and when you compact. But let's deal with that as a separate issue. Anything else on issue 115 before we move on? All right, nothing else. Issue 114 is next, which affects the syntax, could potentially affect the syntax. Marcus, I believe you raised this one. Want to give us an introduction to it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really an issue. It's more about a shared understanding, I would say. And that came up because of the previous issue, and it's basically about what's the value space of the different keywords. So, for example, in add type, do we support objects in there or just strings? The same goes for, I don't know, add value, does that support arrays, for example? I mean, basically just once for all to agree on the value space of all of our keywords.
Yeah.
I think for value we've talked about value before and the possibility of its having an array and how that might mean, and we rejected that in the past.
Yeah, that's true.
The case for type and possibly for ID as well is if it could also accept something that's as an object which represents, say, a subject reference. And the main use case for that was in the context coercion case, where you are turning something that is a regular property into a keyword property. And I was considering it for type, but possibly it could also be considered for ID.
Hold on. So is what I just typed in there, Greg, does that capture it? Is that what you meant, or did you mean something different?
No, that's what I meant, yes.
Okay. So, Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I think that I'll have to run pretty soon. But given Postel's law coming up before, we might want to keep a perspective in mind where we define the value space of the keywords, but we will probably, in at least some of these cases allow for stranger values to appear and then turning them back into something. For instance, given the previous discussion, we said that a graph could take a string or a list of strings, but it might be that we won't even in compacted form have that as an array of object references, I mean the objects with ID keys. That would mean that we have, as exemplified in the issue, that the value space is graph, for graph is array of object, but we may allow something else and turn it into proper JSON-LD.
Mm-hmm.
So to keep in mind the distinction between correct JSON-LD and ways to understand malformed JSON-LD.
Right.
Predictably understand.
Yeah, and I guess the other concern I have is that the more we allow, the more complex the implementations get. Right. So the question is, do we throw an exception when we see something that's, you know, not the proper range and correct the author at that point? And these are developers, so they're a little more in tune with what you need to do from a programming standpoint than, let's say, a web designer would be.
Do we take the XHTML or the HTML path?
Yeah, you're right. Right. And I think in some cases we've taken the HTML5 path with, you know, how much JSON-LD allows to be in there. So it allows values that it has no idea to just continue to exist in there. But in this case, I'm just concerned that the implementations would get a little more complicated than they needed to be. But all that needs to happen is for someone to start authoring bad documents and for someone then to say, oh, well, my JSON-LD processor can interpret that and none of the other ones can. And then you've got this kind of stuff creeping into all the other implementations because they have to support that as well now.
For a bunch of these, we probably can define a very clear recovery operation. If the value is not of the given value range, this is the way to recover from that.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps have a flag for recovery mode or strict mode. I'm not sure, but
right.
It's.
But what's the advantage of all the complexity?
JSON-LD is more forgiving to markup errors or ways that authors kind of see the model in their head, meaning that...
And things that might happen during coercion,
right,
during expansion, applying a context.
Yeah. I mean, it's really... Given that it's JSON, of course, JSON doesn't even allow a trailing comma, so...
There's syntactic normality, and then there's semantic, and this is more on the semantic side. I mean, we need to consider how these things that expected single values would resolve. For instance, an ID, if it received an array, I think at one time we had said, well, we should just accept the first value or the last value of that array as what it represents.
Yeah. And I think that to some extent this is a syntax in a syntax, and we are now discussing whether we should allow trailing commas or not, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I couldn't because I depend upon a JSON parser, which blows up if it sees that.
Yeah, we can't allow trailing commas directly. Yeah, I know, but we can allow, for instance, an array in ID and just pick one. So we can allow such things even if we need to find the value space of that. So it's an explicit recovery from a malformed.
And we perhaps could have a general statement on basically how processors should deal with data which comes in an unexpected format. And that can just come down to the various different types. If a if a property it expects a single value and it's given an array, it uses, you know, a predictable element from that array. If it expects a string and it's presented with an object, then it deals with it in this way. So it doesn't need to be repeated in each individual step.
Yep. Okay, so let's see. I think that Marcus, in that bug, let's go down to the very bottom. The value space for context is an array of objects or a string, which is an IRI. I think that's true. Graph is an array of objects or a string. And that's questionable. The string part's questionable right now. Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm sorry, for compacting?
We interpret that as an IRI all the time.
This is the value space of graph. What's the value space of graph? But yeah, I guess you could have a string and it's treated as an IRI.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's, to me, a recovery.
Okay, so let's take string out of graph. So the ID is a string, value is a string, number, boolean, or null value. We're not doing lists just yet. Is that correct? Yes, that's correct.
We're not doing what yet?
Lists, values with lists. Language is a string, that's right. Type is an array, a single string or an array of strings. Container is a, say is a keyword?
Container is only used in the context.
Yeah.
Yes, and so it must be the string value.
Yep.
Yeah.
Semantically a keyword, but yep.
Right. And then list is an array of objects, strings, numbers, booleans, nulls, or any mixture of those. Set is the same thing.
Meaning that an object or an array of an object, string, number, boolean, null, or an array of any of those.
Yep.
Or a combination,
including any
of those.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it seems. Okay, so it seems like we agree with what Marcus put down there as the value space of keywords. Modulo graph shouldn't have the or string bit in there, and the list and set probably need to be cleaned up a little bit to be a bit more clear about what we allow.
And what about that type? We just talked about that a second ago about having objects for at type.
Well, so there's the value space, and then there's the recovery or the implicit conversion space, right? So we could say
I see the value space if something is not in the value space, I throw an exception. Otherwise, I can't process it.
I think that's something you may be doing in strict mode. But if you're in recovery mode, and I think by default we're in recovery mode, then you try to coerce data using predictable rules into this form.
Yeah, but if we are by default in recovery mode, why do we have to talk about the value space then in some strict mode? So let's talk about the value space in recovery mode, which is the default.
I think the value space should describe what is produced by, what is the output of the algorithms.
Yeah.
Okay, I was talking about the input. Because the output is deterministic by the algorithms. The input is not.
So, for instance, for type, it's unambiguous what the author's intent is if you're given an array of subject references or a subject reference, meaning an object with an ID. And I think that is where we would... Well, if we want to support setting type as the as an alias for some other IRI or term, and turn data that came in some other format into normalized JSON-LD, which is one of our objectives, then I think we need to be to expect to get data in that format, to certainly be the case, given what we've talked about with the from RDF conversion, having the use of at type as being optional, meaning that that RDF type could now go into some other property, which would be now in, through processing, be as a subject reference. If I want to expand that by applying a context which says the that RDF type should be expanded to at type, and if the processor does not accept something in an in a subject reference form, then it wouldn't work. So I'd say that's a specific case that drove allowing it for type.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you turn off the at type in from RDF, there is no, I wouldn't see any reason why to support coercion to at type later on by hard code casting it to at type.
Well, I think we have to support coercion to keywords of things. If we want to be able to accept foreign JSON, which is certainly something that that's a specific objective. So take normal JSON, be able to apply it, but provide a context to it to turn it in.
But are you talking about coercion to, right, type. What? I'm a bit confused.
I mean,
I got to run anyway.
A JSON document will not have an RDF type in there, so I don't expect that to happen. So that you have to put type keyword.
The higher level thing is
you can
let's get away from that specific use case. I think the idea is Postel's law built into JSON LD to the degree that when parsing input, are we by default forgiving of the form of that input, and when we can turning it into something that is in a more normal form or not? And I think that is the purpose of a strict mode. Is that a strict mode allows you to say, to be pedantic about your input and generate exceptions or warnings when you see something that's not in that format. And otherwise, if I see a type with a subject reference, the author's intention is clear. So accepting that and turning it into in this case, the actual string, I think makes perfect sense. The same is true for graph. If given a string, even though that the value space is that of a subject definition or a subject reference, that a string, it's unambiguous what the author's intent is. It's to be interpreted as an IRI.
Yeah, if it's unambiguous, I think we should have a recovery mode, because nobody likes a pedantic compiler anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with that, but then we don't have to call it strict mode, because strict mode is something I understand that's according to spec, and the others are optimizations which my implementation forgives or is able to handle nevertheless. And I've never seen a spec which has a strict mode and a lax mode, and supports both have to be supported. And
I guess that's another issue.
At some point, we have to decide on what we support and what we are not supporting, because we have, implementers have to know what they have to deal with and what they have to handle, and they can otherwise safely throw an exception if something else comes in.
Yeah, and but that's why we should define the mechanism for. I don't know if we should call it recovery then, and we might not have any strict mode on this. We should possibly just...
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that this discussion is going a bit in the wrong direction, I think. We should discuss here what, in whatever that mode is called, in the most forgiving mode that the implementation has to support, what's the value space there? What do we support in that case? It's not about the most tricky case, which will never happen then.
Well, I think someone reading the spec might reasonably think that in the case of ID or type, that they can use an expanded representation of an ID, because we talk about the expanded representations of IDs. I've made that mistake earlier, thinking that that would be the case, and it seems a reasonable interpretation to do that.
Yes, I'm not
just like with
to.
Container, does or with a list or set or graph. Does it always, even though we always will emit it as an array in array form, we accept things that aren't in array form because the author's intention is clear. So I'd say that if we were to say anything, it's where the author's intention is clear. And when we're interpreting things where the author's intention is clear, then we should support that. Otherwise, we need to start throwing exceptions when we see list that doesn't have an array, or set that doesn't have an array, or graph that doesn't have an array. We have a lot of test cases that don't do that. So one thing I'm hearing,
sorry, Nicholas, let me jump in real quick here. One thing that we're saying is that I think all of us believe that when the author's intent is clear, we should try and do what we can to read in the JSON-LD and not throw an exception. Does anyone disagree with that? Forget about lax and strict mode. As a general rule, I think we're all saying that.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead, Nicholas.
Yeah, I'm going to run now, but I'll leave you with, we might want to call it preferred form instead of strict mode and define it out of this is the value space and explain the lax value space, but we could define the preferred form.
Why do we need two forms?
Well, the preferred form of list is an array of anything, but...
but who prefers that?
If I have the keyword list... Well, the compactation prefers that, for instance.
Yeah, but that's the output format of an algorithm. That's not a form. That's compacted form, then, if you want to call it a form.
Yeah, but it seems that as if what we're talking about when we're talking about the value space and the recovery is the value space we are discussing primarily is what I call the preferred form of an expression, the way you should express yourself. But for instance, for a type, you should use, well, I don't know what the preferred form is there, probably either array of string or just a string. They have both the same value from an author perspective. We think that they are just as fine, but using an ID reference is a non-preferred form, but it's still allowed.
Okay, what I was meaning when I raised this issue here was to define the input value space of a processor that it can handle and can produce and to do expansion or whatever it wants to do. So what form an author can possibly write that the processor will still work?
So I guess, Marcus, then what you would like to see as a result of this issue is a value space for each mode the processor can be placed into.
Well, I'm still not convinced that we need different modes, but yeah.
Right, but assuming that we have different modes, that would resolve your issue.
Yes.
Okay, and I believe that the value space that you have expressed in the issue is the strict value space if we have multiple modes for the processor. So what we need to do is we need to generate value spaces for lax mode and
Well, I think it's not entirely. List and set in a strict mode should always be in array form, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Same with graph.
Okay, so can we talk about the
and should
mode
always be
mode?
Object.
Hold on, say that again, Marcus.
Could we just talk about the most forgiving mode we will ever implement or specify or whatever?
I think we should talk about that, but not on the call, because we could spend a very long time discussing each one of these items. I think what I'd prefer is if someone were to write up that list, and all of us can take a look at it during the next call. Because I think that it's we could have an argument about every single one of these things in a different area of a JSON-LD document, and I don't want to spend our time on the call doing that. So why don't we? I think we've one thing that we've made clear is that let me do a proposal here. We're basically saying that. Let's see. I'm looking back to something that I described. So as a general rule, if the author's intent is clear, we should transform it into proper JSON-LD. I think that's effectively what we found by discussing this item or this issue.
Well, we knew that already before, because everything depends on expansion, and the result of expansion is well defined.
I would argue that we had never all of us said this and agreed to it. In that, you know, when the author's intent is clear, I don't know if that was necessarily ever said. The author's intent is clear, we should transform the input. Okay, so in general, if the author's intent is clear, we should transform the input into proper JSON-LD, keeping the processor mode, if any, in mind. Okay, so this, in general, if the author's intent is clear, we should transform the input into proper JSON-LD, keeping the processor mode, if any, in mind, in strict mode, throw exceptions, in lax mode, attempt to interpret the value. And that last bit doesn't come into play if we don't have multiple processor modes. Everything would be strict mode, and we'd just throw exceptions if it didn't hit the value space. Okay.
Cool. Well, gotta run.
We'll need
thank you. Guys.
Okay. Thanks, Nicholas.
All right.
Bye.
Yeah. Bye.
Okay.
We'll need to update the test suite to be able to pass in such flags to be able to actually test behavior.
Right. Or name them in a way.
By the way, is there currently a way in the test suite to express that an exception is expected?
No, there's not currently, and I had thought we might do that with just a different set of tests, but because almost always these exceptions will be triggered when doing expansion, but it's almost always. I think there are cases in compaction that might generate an exception. So I think for flags and exceptions, we probably need to add things to the vocabulary so that can be used when evaluating the behavior or expressing the input, processor inputs.
Okay.
Yeah, just a flag, like expected exception or something, yeah.
Yep. Okay, so looking back through the list, 114, 115, which one of these would be fairly quick and easy to discuss? Data round tripping, I think we're almost done with that. I hope we're almost done with that.
We just shifted it to RDS,
right.
From RDS.
Okay.
We did.
And
I think we are. Yeah, I think that's what we decided. We by meaning that I believe we agreed that numbers and Booleans are expanded to use at value where it is the number Boolean in the value. I think we agreed on that last week.
Okay. So when expanding, the value is kept as kept
it,
as.
Isn't that also affecting RDF round tripping?
Well, what we tried to do is make it so that we don't do any conversion in expansion and compaction or framing. So
yeah,
then that moves
wrong,
moves the issue to RDF conversion. And there, I think Dave Longley's, is that in this thing? Dave Longley's thought was that we add options that express how to deal with each of the different data types. I'm trying to find that.
That was to what
yeah.
the properties are which types are used, but not how the integer or how the Boolean is like that. Percentage
it's not in this
whatever format.
Sorry?
That was about whether which data type is used, so if it's used XSD Boolean or XSD integer, but not about that percentage 1.6e or 1.15e or whatever that was.
Oh, right, right.
So I guess I'm somewhat confused as to why we still have this issue open. So I thought at some point Marcus said, or Marcus or Greg made the point that XSD is very specific about the range. And so if we're converting to and from RDF, and the RDF number, whatever number you know we have, it's like an XSD decimal or whatever, I mean, it's expressed as a string in RDF. Right? No. Well. Yeah,
so
is,
there is a
yeah.
there is a normalized form for each of the XSD types, and the normalized form for a double is very close to what you get from 1.15 capital E, except that in that case, trailing zeros after in the fractional part are trimmed, as are extra zeros, I think, in the mantissa, whereas 1.15e always uses two digits in the mantissa and uses a full 15 digits. But it's valid. It just isn't the normal form.
Couldn't we just say that in 2RDF conversion, we rely on the underlying toString function for converting a double to a string?
So is that going to be consistent in different implementations? If it's not, then it makes it very difficult to test. 1.15e was intended to be something that operates consistently across different implementations and is easy then to test the results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the problem is that JSON doesn't specify any value space for numbers, so there is no consistency there. That's the whole.
Well, I guess we're very specific. It's only data coming in from RDF, right? And I guess
well, 1.15e.
Go ahead, Greg.
All right. So yeah, do we convert when we have something which is a double, and we generate RDF? Is the RDF generated using that, say, 1.15e format? And secondly, when we have a double coming in from RDF, is it always represented in, or actually, I don't know if we can represent it in the output JSON using that. It's just a number.
Yeah.
I guess, hold on, Greg. The one thing I'm confused about is I didn't think that you could express a double in RDF. It's always a string, right? It's only going to RDF, that's the issue. No?
Well, RDF is, of course, is an abstract format. And
right.
In that case, it's represented basically as a string with a data type.
Mm-hmm.
But in a turtle serialization, for instance, you can't express it as it's not a string. You can represent booleans, integers, decimals, and doubles using their native formats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I guess the question is, are we going to and from the RDS model, or are we going to and from a specific syntax? Because it could potentially be different for every syntax.
We're going to and from the model.
But
we're going to and from the abstract syntax, I should say. So the abstract syntax, the representation for a double is a string in a that is formatted in a way that's consistent with the XSD representation, and then a data type, which is an IRI. But there, the other RDF conversions, for instance, if I'm using Turtle and I have something which is in a float format, there is no indication there that there's any transformation made upon that when it's turned into that expanded form. We've done that in JSON-LD. I think Marcus's point is that by requiring this format transformation, we're doing something different than what other RDF representations do. So why not just use two-string?
Yeah.
And I think the argument for that is that our tests are checking the value space and not the abstract value space. If I was to test things in RDF, usually what I do is I have an expected value and I have a result value. I transform them both to the abstract form, and then I test the abstract forms, which is more of an object representation. We're doing value space tests. So having some normal way to turn, say, these double values into allows for that value test.
Okay. So I guess my initial thought on it is I don't think that we should depend on two-string. I think we should be very specific in this case, just for interoperability concerns. One for test suite concerns and the other one for interoperability concerns, mostly because the range of XSD is very well defined, right? And because of that... Well, but we're not talking about JSON. We're talking about to and from RDF, and specifically we're talking about to RDF, right?
Yeah, but first of all, you have to get it out of JSON, and then you have to put it back into JSON. So you can't talk about it without taking JSON into consideration.
I don't understand.
Value comes out from a JSON document and goes into an RDF document. So first of all, you have to get it out of that JSON. And there already you are not sure if the number is really the number that's written there. If it's, well, you don't, there is no value space defined in JSON.
Right, but what we're saying is we are defining the value space. Since there is nothing, right, defined in JSON and we want interoperability is a concern, we are defining a value space.
That doesn't bring us interoperability because we always depend on that underlying code, which is not specified.
I guess the only point that this becomes a concern is when people are encoding 128-bit either floating point or double numbers and then converting them into a native JSON value, right?
On the implementation, it can also be that 32-bit is too much. I don't know.
But there's no implementation. There's absolutely no JSON implementation right now that I know of that has that limitation.
Well, we're specifying XSD double. That has a specified range which requires 64 bits to express. That's the whole purpose of having XSD double. So we're not using XSD float, say, which I think float is a 32-bit representation. We're using double. And if a processor can't use that, then it can't be conformant in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's the easiest approach, at least, to address this issue, is we're basically saying, look, when it comes to XSD decimal, it's a 64-bit number, and it's formatted exactly like that. And that's it. The end, right? And that at least addresses the interoperability concern. There's an argument that maybe, you know, NASA wants to use 128-bit double values, but if they want to do that, they should either create their own data type for that and then express it as a string always, or they should be fine with it, or they need to be understand that there's going to be a truncation at 64 bits. So they're going to see immediately that their values that are supposed to be 128 bits long are truncated.
Okay, then why don't we rely on the underlying two string, which, as you say, should always be 64 bit?
No. We can't rely on that because it might be 64 bit or it might be 128 bit, right? So what I'm saying is that we're being very specific. We're saying with XSD double, we're not taking anything else into consideration. XSD double is a 64 bit number, and because it's a 64 bit number, we know exactly how to represent it, right? 1.15e. So if they want to use a 128-bit number, do not use XSD double because it's completely out of the range of XSD double. Does that make sense? The argument against two string is that we don't know what the underlying we don't know what the underlying implementation is going to do, right? So if it ends up encoding the string as a 128-bit string with that amount of precision, we don't have anything that's very it's just not specific. It's your 2RDF could result in a 64-bit number or it could result in a 128-bit number depending on your implementation. Rather than regardless of which implementation you use, you will always get 1.15e for an XSD double. And that will result in truncation for 128-bit numbers, right? Because we don't want people to accidentally end up knowing that their data, accidentally finding out that their data was truncated. It's always truncated at 64 bits. Does that convince you one way or the other, Marcus?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, but I don't see what problems it really solves. And, yeah, I mean, I don't have a strong opinion about that. And I just don't feel really comfortable with defining 1.15e, where others argue about 1.16e, and then we find Greg found that one simple example which failed already with 1.15e.
116. I think 115.
Or
I didn't find it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the general thing that we're saying is that there is an expression format right now. 1.15e seems to work across all implementations. If we find that it's broken in some way, or if it doesn't work, then we will fall back to two string, right? Basically, if we believe that we have consistency right now with 1.15e. If we find out that it's actually not consistent, then we have no consistency story. And so at that point, we can fall back to two string. Does that seem like a reasonable approach to dealing with the consistency issue at least?
So why don't we just specify the output should be a 32-bit floating point number?
A 32-bit? Because that's not an XSD double.
Or 64, sorry.
I still don't think that's an XSD double, is it, or it's not a full representation for it?
Well, I believe that the XSD double is designed to be compatible with the IEEE double floating point representation, which is standard in processors. Pretty much any processor going back almost to the dawn of my days. So that's in the point of 1.15e is to be able to express that range. And I think if we don't do that, then if we just rely upon two-string, then we'll easily find ourselves in the case where someone implements tests to see what the values are like, and if comparing just the JSON representations, two different otherwise conforming implementations would fail because of slight differences in the way they represent just the two-string value versus the 1.15e representation. So I think just from a practicality point of view, it's convenient for us to make use of that. Otherwise, we can't do just JSON value space conformance tests. We would actually have to turn things back into some object space to be able to do comparisons.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not hearing a strong argument against this from you, Marcus. Meaning that you said that you're you don't have a very strong opinion on this, and I think both Greg and I and Dave Longley would want to be very consistent across implementations, and the only consistency that I can see is if we do the 1.15e. If we do that, we believe we have consistency across implementations. If later on it's proven that we actually don't and that doesn't result in a consistent value, then the only option is to fall back to the two-string mechanism in the processor, and we have no consistency.
Yeah, actually, it was Dave Longley who argued to use the two-string method. So
did he?
You might want to use. You might want to ask him.
Okay.
He wrote that in his comment.
I'm looking for that right now.
Yeah. At least that's surprising.
The last one I see is, he says, the reason for requesting 15 digits of precision is that nearly all modern systems should be able to provide that. Did he say someplace else?
It's
not popping out to me.
Me neither.
I just posted a link on IRC. That's the comment I'm talking about.
Let's see, when was that? A month ago. He might have changed his position on this because that was earlier. This was before we started discussing about blocking it off into and from RDF. Although I still don't see where he's saying that.
He says we should effectively treat type as opaque when expanding and compacting, which is what I think we have agreed upon.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he said the only time we should do that is with normalization. And I think that in subsequent discussions we decided, well, that really is to and from RDF because that's the necessary way to get into the normalized format.
Yep, yeah, that's exactly right.
So that's consistent with saying don't screw with it in expansion and compaction.
Right.
Which is fine.
And he also says, I think the only time we should use a 1.16e formatting is with normalization. So it's still, I don't think that's a two-string mechanism. It's the, printf 1.15e thing we're talking about right now.
Well, if you read on, I will add to this that you might get a different output from normalization for a double than from expansion. So I think he meant the two-string method there.
Yeah, potentially.
The next comment. So.
Should be depending
well,
Yeah, and at that point, you know, he says you should not be depending on doubles for any sort of accuracy or consistency, and that's, you know, that is basically what, that's the underlying thing that's driving this, right? Is that if you go outside of the range of a double, you shouldn't expect there to be any kind of accuracy or consistency. But if you stay within the range in a 64-bit double, you can at least expect that to be valid across implementations or consistent across implementations. Okay. So I think the proposal then is that when converting to RDF, any value that is, let's see, when converting to RDF, any value that is a JSON number that is a, I guess is this, that is a XSD double? No, that is, any that is a JSON number that is a double?
XSD. Every JSON number that is, that has a fraction.
Well, it's either something which is a double, or something which has a fractional value as a JSON number, which is uncoerced. So when we convert it to RDF, we always expand first, and that would expand to it might expand to something with a type with XSD double, or just a value which is a number.
Right.
And in the case that number contains a fractional bit, it is to be treated as an XSD double when converted to RDF.
Any value that JSON number that has a fractional value must be treated as an XSD decimal? Double?
Double.
Okay. Treated as an XSD double. When serialized to RDF. When converted to RDF, any value that is a JSON number that has a fractional value must be treated as an XSD double. What was the last part you said, Greg?
When converting to RDF. That's actually, you said that at the beginning.
Yeah, okay.
Must be treated as an XSD double, period.
An XSD double with a, I guess we should put the 1.15E, right, in there?
Using the 1.15 capital E representation.
1.15E representation. And I guess that's the printf, official printf representation?
Yeah.
Okay. Then Lane. a very weak resolution. Okay, I think that's we'll try that out for now and see if that ends up resulting in something that's useful. We have 10 minutes left. Which one of these would be the easiest one to deal with in 10 minutes? Strict mode, mandatory API parameters via options, or more specific frame matching?
Let's talk a little bit about API parameters.
Okay, issue 112.
My reaction to that was if things are options, I think having mandatory options is a little odd. I think if we need to describe more fully what the range of options may be, that's fine. But if it's an option, it's not mandatory.
I guess we could say that these things have a default. Well, actually, that doesn't necessarily work, because I believe the reason Marcus raised this was because there are certain things like the base IRI that is mandatory, right? You can't do anything without that. Or we could say that the base IRI is set to, you know, blank or foo or whatever the current document is, or you know, or something, some kind of URN if it's not specified.
So you're saying, what are the default values of options? It's not one that the use of the when the options are used, they're used by the processor is mandatory. If it's expressed,
yeah.
It's mandatory, with the exception of optimize, which has no specific meaning, right? It's not intended to. But base IRI, for instance, yes, if it's not expressed, then a processor should act as if it is set to the IRI of the loaded document if it's known.
Right.
No type would be set to false by default. So in the absence of that option, it's to be treated as if it's false. And if we add the other things for Boolean, integer, decimal, then they would have similar effects.
I didn't quite catch that, Greg. What was that?
There was a discussion in the from RDF case whether the result of transforming to JSON from RDF, if you have a Boolean or say an integer or a double, results in the use of a native JSON representation. And there was a proposal that I think from Dave Longley in the last, I forget exactly where it is, that there be options to control that behavior for each of the various different types of conversions that might exist.
Okay. Marcus, what are your feelings on basically saying that all of these things are options, but we are very clear about what the default value for it is? So, for example, I think base IRI...
We just have to specify it somewhere, because we lost that kind of...
Yeah.
By putting it just in that object. So, for example, the base has to be passed if the document is passed as an already parsed object, for example, and has relative IRIs in it, for example.
Oh, so you're saying that if a document is parsed which does not have a location, then the base IRI must be set to an absolute IRI. Is that...
Well, that's the question, for example.
Yeah,
either
I would say
we require it all the time, or we just throw an exception if you find a relative IRI, for example.
Well, no other RDF processor that I've done does that, and that's often not the case. For instance, in Turtle, it's common for the output to be expressed in relative form, which you can't really process. So I don't see an example of another RDF processor that requires that a base IRI be provided.
Why don't we just go ahead and place it into the blank node space? Anything that's a relative IRI gets shoved into the blank node space by default, so that you know when people see this stuff pop up, they'll see all of their relative IRIs have underscore colon and then the name after that, which they'll be like, okay, well, obviously I need to set the base IRI, meaning that it's very clear from the beginning that they need to set something, right, and that the base IRI isn't set. That way we don't have to throw an exception. You know, we don't have to throw an exception in that case. We can just say, look, if you don't specify the base IRI, we will use underscore colon as a base IRI.
Which requires us to remap every blank node in expansion already.
Yeah, they'd be remapped next to each. I don't think we remap in expansion. We remap in
not
framing.
Apparently, but if we introduce that change, we will have to.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't know about the putting everything in blank node space. I would just say, if we don't have tests for it, that behavior is processor dependent, which is the case for every other RDF processor that I've done. I typically default it to something like example.com because it's really only there for the purpose of very quick examples where I'm running things to see what the results looks like. And something like example.com just allows it to take a format that I can see. And it does allow you to determine whether you have the result is, say, an illegal IRI after performing expansion. Blank node would be really weird. If I did that with Turtle, say, and I just put a document in, and I just enter it into a, let's say, my distiller, and all of a sudden I got blank nodes out, that would completely change the way that data looked.
Yeah, that's true. Strike that I made that suggestion. We shouldn't use blank nodes. So we could do, yeah, I mean, we could leave it up to the processor. Or we could, I think I'd rather that we specify something just so that all the processors kind of do the same thing.
Well, it should be treated as if it is empty.
The blank
dropped.
Say that again, sorry?
I'm sorry. I'd just say that
dropped.
It's...
Oh, sorry.
I've got a message being left that I can't turn off.
So, Marcus, go, and then you, Greg. Marcus, what were you going to say?
I was saying if we don't expand it to a full IRI or blank node or something, this properties would get dropped from the output.
Yeah, that's true. And that would be confusing. I think that would be kind of confusing for developers. We could set it to http://, and then it would quite obviously be an invalid IRI.
But I mean, in this specific case, is it really that bad to throw an exception to say that something is wrong here?
No, not really.
Well, I think the problem is requiring the processors throw an exception. Because again, if I'm just thinking of a distiller case, it's someone just going to go in, type in, like in the playground, say, type in something. What are you doing? What does the playground do? You type in JSON-LD, and you use relative IRIs. There is no place to enter what the absolute IRI is to use. Yet that's something we want to allow people to do, encourage people to do. Now, I don't know what the playground uses for an IRI in that case.
Yeah, the playground would probably...
I think in the playground, you can just specify the default one.
Let's pull that up.
Hello.
Hi, Marcus. good old 2-hour time limit.
Yeah. You still didn't change that.
No, I probably should.
Probably it's good to remind us that we are over time.
Right. Yeah, otherwise we'd go for another hour. It's midnight where you are. Okay, so while we're waiting on Greg, I don't know. I think the playground, it sets its... hi, Greg. I was just saying that the playground sets the base IRI, so I don't think that that's too big of an issue.
It sets it to playground.
Yeah, it just sets it to the current document.
Yeah, I think that's really useful in this case. So if you were to enter some simple JSON, and in this case I just did pound foo, and if that generated an exception, it would be really not useful for developers. So requiring it to generate an exception there, I think, is a problem.
I guess what we could say is that if there is a document context or a document context is known, use the document IRI as the base. If you don't have any such thing, then use example.com as the base. Otherwise, they provide it. I mean, I think that makes it so that we don't have to throw an exception, and I'm sure that the developer would look at that output and go, oh, example.com, why is that happening, and then end up setting the base IRI shortly thereafter.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that there's only so much that we can do to prevent them forgetting to put the base IRI in the options. Marcus?
Well, but I mean, the playground or anything else is an application, whereas the processor, I see that as a library, and it's better to find out sooner than later that you have to set a base IRI if you have invalid data, not that you ship some application without ever thinking about the base IRI.
Well, so if I do this, if I put this into my distiller, I just put in ID hash foo, type bar, and I transform it to turtle, then I get angle brackets hash foo a angle brackets bar, which I think is quite consistent with the way that people colloquially use this type of thing, at least use turtle. So in this case, there is no need for me to input a absolute IRI in order to be able to manipulate it this way. And if I did, it would actually be a little bit less useful. So in this case, I just use it, I treat it as if it's an absolute IRI without validating that it's an absolute IRI, and then output it as such, which works quite perfectly for my purposes.
So, Marcus, what would you still prefer to throw an exception?
I'm currently thinking about, can a property ever be a relative IRI? I think we somewhere specified that.
But this isn't. These aren't properties. In this case, it's not a property. If a property is relative IRI, then it's dropped. In this case,
I've been looking at
is subjects and objects, and those are just, they are assumed to be absolute IRIs expanded relative to base. But in the absence of base, it is just used directly.
Yeah, but can a property ever be a relative IRI? I think somewhere we specified that in the context we just allow absolute IRIs, right?
I'm pretty sure that a property will be dropped if it's a relative IRI. But that's different. I mean, properties do not resolve relative to base. And the discussion we're having is about base. Properties do not resolve relative to base.
Yeah, if we had vocab, do we have vocab? I forget. We don't have vocab.
No.
Because we don't have vocab, property would use vocab if we had it, but since we don't, property is just dropped if it's relative. So what Greg's saying is it's very specific, meaning that the only thing that we care about, the only thing that base affects is the resolution of relative IRIs that are either subjects or objects.
Yes. But in the context, if you specify a term and have add ID, can the value of that ID there in the context be a relative ARI or just be an absolute ARI?
Well, ID is a subject, so it can be a relative ARI.
Yeah.
No, not as a subject. ID in the context definition.
Well, ID, yeah. If it's an ID, it can be relative. If it's in, yeah, if it's expressed via ID, it can be relative, and it's resolved against base.
But I'm confused by what you say in the context. Where would you use ID in the context?
I think that's easier.
If you do like term, like you're specifying a term foo, and then colon on the right side, you have ID in bar. Yeah.
Oh.
Is this allowed, or do we just allow absolute ARIs in there?
I think
I
we just allow absolute ARIs.
I thought
that relative
thought
would
we
be,
would,
yeah. I'm pretty sure that this would cause it to be removed because it does not expand to an absolute ARI.
I thought, okay, so I thought differently. I thought that that would expand to that would be combined with base and it would be an absolute ARI.
Well, you know,
I thought anything in ID can resolves against
yeah.
if it's not absolute.
I have to look at my processor and see exactly what it would do in that case.
And specifically, if there's no colon in there, it's assumed to be a relative ARI. Actually, no. It checks to make sure that there isn't a term already for that, and if there isn't a term already for that, then it's a relative ARI. Right?
Yeah,
if it was like capital person, they would look up person, and if that's not there, then it's a relative ARI, and it's resolved against base.
Yeah. But if it's used in a property position, it would result in it being dropped because it's
that's
not
correct.
Doesn't resolve to it. Yeah, that's I believe that's what happens.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, how about this for a proposal? There are no mandatory options in the JSON LD API. Their defaults are specified for all options. Their defaults must be specified for all options passed to JSON LD API methods. Is that good? And then we'll talk about base in a second. Lane? Okay, and then proposal there, when the default for the base ARI for JSON LD API methods is the current document ARI if let's see, is the current document ARI if in a browser context, or HTTP example.com, if there is no document.
Well, see, I would disagree with that part.
What would you rather see?
If there is a document location, it defaults to the document location.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it is empty.
Well, the document location, you have to pass that to the processor. So, I mean, that's the parameter we are talking about.
For example, in a JavaScript processor in the browser, you would be able to do window.location. The API could do
that
directly. Yeah. Yeah, for something that's not in a browser context, which is what you're talking about, you'd either have to pass it in directly or it's something else, and it's something else that we're discussing right now. So Greg's saying it should just be...
I just say it's empty. And that allows me to treat it as empty the way that I would treat it as empty in Turtle, which is useful. It's useful Turtle. Let me give you the example that I was working with. So this is, let's see, my input document looks like this. And then the resulting turtle looks like this. So I think that's, so basically I've got a simple relative URI. And then the output turtle uses that relative URI without having to have specified base.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I don't have a strong preference either way. I thought you were arguing that we should have example.com.
No. Okay. I think that a processor might do example.com, but I think in this case, there's no need to do it. Now, I can just keep it in relative form. Because RDF certainly doesn't care if the IRIs are relative or not.
Right. Okay, so there's the proposal. And,
great.
Okay. All right. So that's that. Okay. That's the call for today. Thank you, everyone.
No.
Okay. Great. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Right. Bye.
Bye.